Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Keep listening. Get into the flow. That motivational music claims to be able to help you get your mind focused to reach peak performance in the immersive mental state called flow. Is it working for you? Breathe, people. Something like this works for one of you in Seattle, Washington. Suit up, turn off the phone, put on my favorite tunes. Breathe, and the zone cometh. Well, we'd love to know your flow secret. Listening to this program, perhaps? It's enough of that music there, Vince. You can lose that now. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. More on flow later this hour. We'll explore the flow involved at the Paralympics, where the athletes are competing on the edge of human performance in Sochi. And it turns out we can't give up taking cues from the Brits and Joseph Stalin, it turns out, when it comes to our clocks. An author reminds us of the utter meaninglessness of government-enforced daylight savings time, unless you're from England, play golf, or are Joe Stalin, who imposed daylight savings time in the Soviet Union and forgot to take it off. But first, we turn to some very scary reminders of the Stalin period in the Soviet Union, where people were forcibly resettled in the 1950s and 60s. Among those resettled, the Tatars, Muslims in Crimea, moved east under wretched, sometimes fatal conditions, who slowly returned to Crimea, which is now in Ukraine and at the center of the current Ukraine crisis, even though the Tatars have lived there peacefully for decades. Joining us now once again is Natalia Antalava, reporting for PRI's The World from Crimea. Natalia, welcome.
Thank you very much. Hello.
Natalia, are Tatar homes being marked in neighborhoods as they were decades ago during the Stalinist resettlement period, based on your reporting?
Well, we have heard reports for a while of this markings on the doors of Crimean Tatars here, who are in a very vulnerable position at the moment. And yesterday, I did see the evidence of these markings. I went to a mixed Russian-Crimean Tatar neighborhood in the city of Bakhchisarai, and the street that, you know, I personally saw, it was a very small street with about 12 houses, five of which belong to Tatars, and all five of them had crosses scratched into the front gates of their homes. The people that I spoke to, the Tatar families I spoke to, said that, you know, they saw over the weekend men whom they described as skinheads, shaved men with tattoos and earrings going around the neighborhood armed with batons, and the women I talked to said they had lists, and that's how they marked their homes, according to the list they were holding. This is obviously a completely chilling experience for anyone who has gone through the Stalin deportation in 1944. I was talking yesterday to an elderly woman who, when she was 8 in 1944, her home was marked in exactly the same fashion, and literally a couple of days later, the soldiers came to their house and threw the entire family on trains and deported them into exile in Central Asia, where she spent decades and where thousands and thousands of the Crimean Tatars died. And the community leaders here are saying that this is just a sign of the pressure that they are under, because the community is very much very supportive of the government in Kiev. It's a very pro-Ukrainian community, and they very much oppose the Moscow intervention in Crimea, but they also fear that they will be the ones who will pay the price for this opposition.
Well, the political conundrum there for the Crimean Tatars, who and it sounds as though this marking of homes is not being officially sanctioned, but it is an opportunity for some ideological groups. Before we go, is that true?
Well, the locals here say that the danger comes not so much from the disciplined Russian troops who just stand there, but from the tensions that the presence of these troops has unleashed. In the last few days, I have personally been pushed around and called names by several Cossacks and supporters of Putin, this volunteer brigade that we see everywhere. The Crimean Tatars are very wary of the pro-Moscow government that came to power here because they say that a lot of extremist nationalists groups are behind and have always been supportive of these people who are now in power.
Very, very worrying situation there in Crimea. Natalia Antaleva reporting for PRI's The World from Crimea. Meanwhile, the West grapples with what to do about this crisis in Europe.
Crimea is part of Ukraine. Crimea is Ukraine.
Secretary of State John Kerry is correct if he's looking at a contemporary map of the region, but the people of Crimea want to vote to end and decide whether to change that map and become part of Russia. President Obama doesn't like this at all.
The proposed referendum on the future of Crimea would violate the Ukrainian Constitution and violate international law. Any discussion about the future of Ukraine must include the legitimate government of Ukraine.
The Ukraine crisis has stirred up Europe and the West, but we're going to look east now, far east, because possibly the most important implications for this crisis in the coming years will be how it plays out in a similar way among aspiring nationalist movements in Asia and redefines the relationship between China, Russia, India, and Japan. Roger Baker is the vice president of the Asia-Pacific Analysis Group, Stratfor, a global intelligence research firm. This crisis gives Russia a lot of options in Asia, he says, of all places, however it all turns out in Europe.
What the Russians are likely to do is really try to accelerate their relationship with Japan at this time. That's a key U.S. ally. The Japanese have a very strong interest in securing their relationship with Russia for easy access for natural gas, to resolve some of the island disputes that they have, to secure their northern flank.
And also to have just someone in their corner to face China.
Certainly. And so Russia is likely to be more willing to make a deal on the northern territories, on the Kuril Islands, maybe strike something that the Japanese are going to be willing to accept so the Japanese start putting money into eastern Russia. At the same time, though, Russia won't side only with Japan. They're going to make sure that they strike a similar gas deals with the Chinese so that Russia remains the arbiter in the area and not dependent upon one of these consumers.
Is the dynamic going forward in Asia that Russia stays secure and together and that China simply goes stronger, or are we going to see more evolution of the map of Asia in the early part of this century?
The place where Russia and China are really going to have some competition is over Central Asia. The Chinese have expanded substantially into Central Asia for energy resources, for transportation routes. And if Russia is reasserting its national self-interest in its near abroad, in its periphery, at some point this is going to run up against the Chinese. And we're looking now at several of the leaders in Central Asia who have been there forever, who are very old, who don't have a good succession plan, and are already having some crises within their own political organizations.
So as Russia attempts to expand in Europe, we may see a rollback of the traditional Russian territorial conquest of Siberia and Central Asia in this century?
Or the Russians decide that they really need to push that as well, and it puts the Russians into a more confrontational attitude with the Chinese than we've seen in a long time.
Do you believe that the Russians can win a battle with the Chinese over Central Asia, or will it fall apart?
Well, I think that Russia has more levers in Central Asia still than the Chinese do. The Chinese have been throwing money in, but the Russians have very long-standing relationships. The Russians have a standing military presence. But the risk in Central Asia is that as we start to see these leaders die, that there is no way for the countries to hold together. And if you go back to the way in which the Soviets designed the shape of the region, they intentionally cut and split and altered all the different ethnic groups so that they overlap and so that none of the five stands can ever really be truly dominant in the region. And that competition within the stands rises up. The Russians and the Chinese take sides, and you can have some particularly interesting crises happening in that area.
And it's also the case that the long history of Russia in Central Asia and Siberia has produced grievances. I mean, there are angsts and grievances against the Russians that if the power shifts, will rise up and push people into the Chinese sort of zone of influence, I would suspect.
There certainly are, but the Chinese in some ways are playing with fire as well, because a lot of these groups in Central Asia that are opposed to Russia are the same groups that could be linked into, say, the ethnic Turkestani and the Uyghurs in China's far west. And these are the ethnic groups that the Chinese are worried about, the ones who may have been responsible, for example, for the attack in Kunming this week.
Will we see an Asia that looks more like the Balkans, only 1,000 times the size of the territories, sometime this century?
Central Asia, I think that's a possibility.
And that would be hugely destabilizing for the world. I mean, that's a kind of Sarajevo.
It is, but in some sense, it's very isolated in its location.
So was Sarajevo in 1914.
Yeah, but a little bit closer to the rest of Europe. If Central Asia starts to unravel, the Chinese really can't focus on their maritime frontier, for example. That gives the Japanese the opportunity to expand their involvement and their action in maritime East Asia. So the Chinese are looking at trying to figure out the way to balance their western frontier and their eastern frontier, which they feel they're being sort of pressed in upon by the United States, by the Japanese, and by their allies.
Does that unraveling favor the United States or produce a kind of Guns of August mentality in the 21st century that could just produce all kinds of unexpected surprises?
Certainly unexpected surprises, but we see the United States shifting from what has been sort of expected from the Cold War period and the early post-Cold War period of a global hegemon or a global policeman role to a United States that's more ready to rely on, say, regional balance of power roles. So that rather than direct intervention, the U.S. only gets involved such that no single power can become dominant. And that means that there's a greater acceptance of regional instability.
So that means that's conceivably a formula for allowing some of these territories to change hands in the early going and figuring out what the red lines are down the road. Maybe the U.S. only has an interest in allowing Putin to take Crimea. And the question is, will they feel the same about Uzbekistan?
Yeah, and I think the whole concept of red lines is going to go away pretty fast because they seem to be – if you choose not to enforce them, they're fairly useless in the first place. But the U.S. is going to accept more of these types of changes, more local competition, just so long as no single power is able to dominate. So if it means that the Chinese and the Russians are having heavy competition in Central Asia, that in some sense is of benefit to the United States because the countries are focused on that area where they meet and not focused on expanding in other directions.
Roger Baker, Vice President of Asia Pacific Analysis at Stratfor, a global intelligence research firm. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Still to come, getting into the state of flow or the zone at the Paralympics in Sochi, it's the key to getting a mental edge for the competitors. We'll hear from Stephen Kotler, author of The Rise of Superman, decoding the science of ultimate human performance.
At the elite levels, fitness is pretty much on par. Everybody's kind of, they're all in great shape. The difference is the mental edge, and flow is the ultimate mental edge.
How do you get there? Fernandina Beach, Florida. I have to make a written list of tasks. I cannot mentally list all of them without losing a few. Then shut out all the other distractions with a minute of quiet focus time. Then prioritize the list, stack them, pack them, and rack them. Brighton, Michigan, don't think. Relax, focus, ignore the score. Slow it all down. Relax. How do you get into your zone? Call us at 877-8MYTAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. Playing with clocks and time, fiddling with them, is a human obsession, from popes writing calendars to enslave us all. Clocks ordering people to pray, ancient clocks staring down on them from the medieval square, bong, bong. There are the complicated wristwatches with so many features we can distract ourselves all day long if we like. We are the human time tweakers, and the twice-a-year national time tweak ritual happens once again this weekend. We go back on daylight savings time, spring forward 1 hour. Around 2 a.m. on Sunday. Michael Downing, that's the title of your book.
It is indeed.
How convenient. Spring forward the annual madness of daylight savings time. You teach creative writing at Tufts University. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Now, this daylight savings time thing, in your view, is a bit of an empty ritual. There is, at least as far as you can tell, absolutely no reason for doing it.
Well, there's a reason for doing it. It's simply not the reason we were told we were doing it for the past 100 years, which was to save energy, which we have yet to do. We haven't squeezed a drop of energy out of our clocks yet. But there are a number of reasons we are doing it and continue to get more of it every year.
And what about, you know, safely getting kids to school in the daylight?
Well, you know, that's a myth, just like the farmer myth. I grew up with the same understanding of daylight saving. It's such a confusing project. Let's face it. Losing or gaining an hour by fiddling with our clocks is at best theoretical or maybe philosophical, and I think that's where the confusion starts. In fact, school children and their advocates have always opposed daylight saving because by moving the clocks forward, we get less morning sunlight and children are out on dark streets. The same goes for the farmers. I always thought we did it for the farmers, that I was assisting American agriculture in some way every spring. Turns out the farmers have always hated daylight saving.
Do you play any golf, Michael?
I don't play golf, but it's a shame I don't because it is the most important reason we're still doing and expanding the period of daylight saving time. Golfers love it for a simple reason.
And in fact, the golf reasoning behind daylight savings time may, in fact, underpin our entire economy. Here, listen to this comment from the CEO of the World Golf Foundation, Steve Mona.
For people who don't play golf, they should care a lot about the fact that daylight savings time creates additional opportunities for people to play golf. And here's why. From an economic standpoint, golf on a national level creates almost $70 billion a year in economic impact. It employs almost 2 million Americans. It generates almost $4 billion in charitable giving, almost all of which goes to causes outside of golf. In addition to that, golf facilities are small businesses, and they're usually among the most stable employers and source of revenue for local suppliers than any other business.
It's a $70 billion stimulus program for the U.S. economy, Michael Downing. What do you think of that theory?
Well, it's good to know that the golfers are so philanthropic, and since we've been giving them an extra $400 million a year, according to them, for every month we add to the Daylight Saving Project, sports have always really profited by this project.
So do you think that this is some sort of underground ruse that the sports lobby, and particularly the golf lobby, tried to get Daylight Savings Time passed by fomenting these false myths about farmers and school kids?
It wasn't even underground. It's really out front. Since 1915, the principal supporter of daylight saving in the United States has been the Chamber of Commerce on behalf of small business and retailers. Here's why. The Chamber understood that if you give workers more sunlight at the end of the day, they'll stop and shop on their way home. It's not just golf. Barbecue industry loves daylight saving. So do the home goods store, because people tend to go out of their houses, see that their roofs need replacing, and buy more shingles. It's a really important part of niche marketing for the retail industry.
Now, I understand that China has a single time zone and doesn't mess around with this daylight savings time much. If they were to do so, would their economy suddenly triple in size and, you know, we would be lost far, far back in the pack?
Well, we don't need to give them another advantage over us economically, but China actually tried daylight saving time once for a 5-year period and then gave it up. As you point out, unlike the United States, which is the same size east to west, China has only one time zone. They don't like people fussing with their clocks. But the rest of the world has been as confused as the United States on this project.
Is there a long tradition of governments fiddling with clocks and trying to control behavior, direct behavior by making a standard national time?
Absolutely. Once we got onto clocks, governments got the idea that they were related somehow to efficiency, and therefore by playing with them, you could increase efficiency. One of the most failed examples of this is Stalin, who was, of course, famous for fiddling not just with clocks but with calendars, having tried to create a 5-day work week so workers wouldn't have weekends anymore. Stalin actually got on the bandwagon early with daylight saving, and one April had all of the Soviet Union turn their clocks ahead. Unfortunately, I'm not making this up, in the fall he forgot to tell the Soviet Union to turn back their clocks. Through World War II and the entire Cold War, all of the clocks in Russia were off by an hour, and it was not noted until the 1980s. So fiddling with the clocks can have its price.
And we're basically following in the tradition of Stalin by engaging in this ritual this weekend.
Well, really, what we're following in the tradition of the Brits, who really fell in love with daylight saving because they just don't have enough sunlight any time of the year. And it was a golfer and a horseman who first noticed Brits sleeping through those early morning sunrise times, putting their curtains up and blocking a natural resource. So he had the idea of forcing people out of the house at the end of the day by turning the clocks forward. And it does work. Americans really do leave their houses when they're given more sunlight after work. But here's the problem. We're told we're saving energy. But when Americans go outside and go to the park and go to the mall, we don't walk. We get in our cars and drive. So for the past 100 years, the dirty secret is daylight saving increases gasoline consumption.
Michael Downing, author of Spring Forward, The Annual Madness of Daylight Savings Time. He teaches creative writing at Tufts University. Thank you, Michael.
Good luck this Sunday.
I happen to have Mr. McLuhan right here.
I heard what you were saying. You know nothing of my work.
Also, dude, Chinaman is not the preferred nomenclature. Asian American, please.
Actually, it's pronounced Milwaukee, which is Algonquin for the good land.
Check out the big brain on bread.
And with Marshall McLuhan's famous cameo in Annie Hall there as part of our movie branding, we welcome Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday, co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway. Welcome, guys.
Hi, John.
On Movie Friday, we've got a sequel to a surprisingly successful graphic novel series, 300 Rise of an Empire, and something that I'm very much looking forward to, but it seems like a bizarre premise for a movie. 300 Rise of an Empire, this did surprisingly well the first time around, Rafer.
Yeah, the original one did. Critics mostly hated it, but it wound up being a huge blockbuster, something like $400 million worldwide.
And the tone will probably be something like the first one.
The Persian king, Darius, annoyed by the notion of Greek freedom, has come to Greece to bring us to heel. He makes landfall at the field of Marathon with an invading force which outnumbers the Greek defenders 3-1. And so at dawn, the hopeless Athenians do the unthinkable. They attack.
No blood in this one, right, Kristen?
That's the only scene with no blood. No, actually, there's tons of blood that's flying all through that. This time, unlike the first one, which was about the Spartans, this is the Athenians versus the Persians. And it's about 90% fighting and about 10% exposition. And I have to say, it eventually all just felt like white noise to me. The exposition is so confounded and impossible to understand, and the fighting seems to be for no reason. I was pretty bored through this.
Rafe.
Yeah, it's basically battle porn. It's a lot of people being stabbed in the mouth and their heads cut off, and it just sort of goes on and on and on. It's got no real story, no real characterization. The first one I actually thought was a lot of fun. That had Gerard Butler. He's not in this one any longer. It's another sort of generic Greek general guy, Sullivan Stapleton. And, it just doesn't hold together the way the first one did.
Same director?
No, different director. Same screenwriter, Zack Snyder, but it's a different director who is basically directing as though he were Zack Snyder.
All right, second offering. Who would have ever thought that there would be a movie adaptation of Mr. Peabody and Sherman?
Mr. Peabody, you're a Nobel Prize-winning scientist, a world-renowned explorer, and you're an Olympic gold medalist in both the long jump and the decathlon. You're sure you're capable of meeting all the challenges of raising a human boy?
Given all that I've accomplished, how hard could it possibly be?
Very well, then. If a boy can adopt a dog, I see no reason why a dog cannot adopt a boy.
With the most primitive of animation, Peabody and Sherman was a very successful part of the Bullwinkle, Rocky and Bullwinkle show. But now with much more sophisticated animation, we get to explore the mystery of why this boy ended up with this dog, Kristen.
We do, and I love the original Rocky and Bullwinkle show. I loved the original Peabody and Sherman. This time around, it's flashier animation. There's the Wayback Machine getting into trouble with time travel. You see the relationship between the dog and his boy. I thought it was pretty good fun, actually. I think there are a lot of bad kids movies out there, but this was pretty good, and it has the bad puns that we all like.
Rafer.
Yeah, the Jay Ward movies have a pretty abysmal track record. George of the Jungle, the Rocky and Bullwinkle one that had Robert De Niro in it.
Oh, that's right.
They've all been pretty bad. This one, I think, really does capture the spirit. You still have all of Peabody's awful puns that you used to punctuate the old segment on television. And yeah, I could have done a little bit without some of the scatological sort of crude humor.
Gotta have that for kids movies these days.
Gotta have that for a kids movie.
Yeah.
But despite that, I think there's something very sweet and fun and pretty funny about this one. I liked it.
Positive on Mr. Peabody and Sherman, not so much on 300 Rise of an Empire, the podcast this week.
We have a really fun guest who knows a lot about dogs, who's going to help us understand what kind of breed Mr. Peabody might be based on his very know-it-all characteristics.
Kristen Meinzer, culture producer for The Takeaway and co-host of the Movie Date podcast with Rafer Guzman, film critic for Newsday. Have a great weekend, guys.
Thanks John.
For the rest of this hour and for the next week, a journey beyond normal. Remarkable feats performed by fearless men and women missing limbs, bones, and sight who compete in the Paralympics, which get underway today. From being unable, they have crafted new events that take their bodies way beyond normal. 80 Americans, 45 nations, 5 sports. Next week, we'll hear from some of the athletes with their customized bodies and radical custom-fitted gear. But first, the games have come a long way. Today, they may be pushing human and machine limits. But in the beginning, Dr. Ian Britton, author of The Paralympic Games Explained, says it was all about giving war victims something to do.
Well, the Paralympic movement in general actually grew out of the rehabilitation of Second World War victims of conflict, mainly soldiers, but some civilians as well, who were received spinal injuries during the Second World War. They were the brainchild of Dr. Ludwig Guttmann, a German-Jewish neurologist who escaped Nazi Germany in 1939. Came to the UK and in 1944 was asked to head up the National Spinal Rehabilitation Unit in Great Britain. And as part of his rehabilitation process, he actually introduced sport for a number of reasons. One, because it was very good for the physical health of the individuals, because prior to that, most of them had just been left lying in beds with no expectations that they would even live, let alone live productive lives. And also as a way of showing the non-disabled population what people with disabilities were actually capable of, because most people, particularly at that time, were sort of socialized to believe that if you became disabled, you were almost basically on the scrap heap of life.
And in the beginning, was the Paralympics more of a recreational outlet? How was the level of competition? And we've seen some pretty ruthless competition in the Paralympics in our time.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously moved on significantly since the early days. I mean, it was more about recreational and rehabilitational sport. Obviously, as we've developed, you know, it really now is just, it is elite sport of the highest level. The athletes train just as hard. They're just as determined to win medals. They're just as proud to represent their country at the Paralympic Games as the Olympians are.
Do you think that it helps or hurts the Paralympic movement to be paired with the able-bodied Olympics summer and winter?
My honest opinion would be that it wouldn't be in the position it's in today without that linkage. I think the linkage has helped significantly develop the Paralympic movement, both in terms of the actual sort of management and structure, but also, you know, in gaining media coverage, in gaining interest and acceptance from countries around the world. Whether that's still the case, you know, going forward in a couple of decades' time, that's a more difficult, more interesting question, possibly.
One of the things I wonder, and this is something that a lot of athletes have told us, is there just seems to be people having a lot more fun at the Paralympics. There's just a greater diversity of athletes, people who just got into the sport, people who spent their life doing the sport, and they're all together out there on the ice and snow.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true. And that's true of the Summer Games as well, I think. You know, I mean, I heard a story from a Paralympic athlete once, a blind athlete. He won numerous gold medals on the track. And he was talking to a guy in a pub who was vastly overweight, you know, drinking sort of 8 pints a night, probably not very healthy. And the guy was asking him what he did. And he told him he was a Paralympic athlete. And the guy sort of said, oh, what's your distance? And at the time it was 1,500 meters. And the guy said, oh, what sort of time do you run? And bearing in mind this guy's totally blind, he'd run under 4 minutes 10 for a 1,500 meters. And the guy's response was, oh, that's not bad. I think I might struggle to do that. You know, I think there's a lack of comprehension of just how good these athletes are.
Oh, that is amazing. Dr. Ian Britton, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Dr. Ian Britton is author of The Paralympic Games Explained, and he's a research fellow at Coventry University in England. I got involved in a film project some years back where we asked people how they might wish to augment their bodies. Everybody had an answer.
I'd like to have a better memory, maybe with memory chips or something. I probably want to be taller so I could play for the NBA.
I want to be shorter. I'm tired of being tall. I just turned 50, so memory is like sort of an issue.
When he was asked this question, my son said he wanted to fly, I recall, while my daughter said she wanted an additional but secret eye. It's a selection from the documentary film Fixed, the science/fiction of human enhancement, where wishes like that become reality for double amputee MIT professor and engineer Hugh Herr, who lost his legs in a mountaineering accident.
12 months after my amputations, I climbed at a more advanced level with artificial limbs than I achieved with normal biological limbs before the accident. I no longer viewed my body in the way society was viewing my body, as being broken, as being disabled, as being crippled.
Lose your legs, gain abilities beyond human biological limits. The technology available today makes such propositions realistic, and with brain implants and advanced nanotechnology, the sacred place called normal seems like some arbitrary barrier, like the old 4-minute mile. Regan Brashear is the producer and director of the documentary Fixed. She says the disabled characters in her film are all breaking free of normal, whether they embrace the new enhancement technologies or not.
It began actually meeting Gregor Wahlbring 10 years back now, and I've been hearing, you know, him describe these new bionic legs, for instance, that would let him run faster and jump higher than, you know, quote unquote normal bodies would be able to, and that just really, you know, caught my attention, and so it really has been a journey sort of meeting all these folks that kind of speak to really different sides of these debates and really challenging my own beliefs. Because, you know, I think I started off with just an alarm, sort of like, what are we doing here? You know, and then meeting people like yourself and Hugh Herr, and that really broadened my perspective of like, well, you know, A, we've been co-evolving with our technologies from day one, and this is, you know, taking it to a new level, but it's not something radically different.
Well, it's certainly radically different for Hugh Herr to say that disability can be technologically eradicated on some level. I mean, when you hear him talk about his artificial legs, he describes them in a way that's both poetic and, you know, completely futurist here.
The industrial design approach that I've taken with these bionic structures is that I want them to have a human-like shape, but I don't want them to look human. Because I want the individual attached to the bionic structure to celebrate the fact that part of their body is artificial. Part of their body is a machine. So I want them to explore machine beauty in the context of human beauty.
What did that mean to you? Machine beauty in the context of human beauty. Celebrating that that's not a leg that looks like a human leg. And that's great. It's better, in fact.
I think he is expressing that new worldview of like that we are evolving with our technologies and that this can be seen as a beautiful thing. And it's an extension of the human body, and it's a new collaboration with machines, and this opening up new worlds and new experiences.
Raises some issues, too. And you explore them here. Jaime Cacheo describes that if suddenly our notion of normal is thrown out and the preferred idea is to reach for these enhanced technological capabilities, it changes the way we look at each other as humans.
Suddenly people who have all along considered themselves to be normal find themselves in a position of no longer being considered good enough. On the other hand, a lot of the tools that people are talking about, ways of improving themselves beyond the normal, are also ways for people who have historically been disabled to go beyond normal as well. So there's the potential for a real shakeup of the concept of what it means to be able and disabled.
Who was the most unsure of this sort of transhumanist enhancement movement? Who was most unsettled and perhaps worried about what this future means?
Well, I mean, I think a lot of folks have voiced concerns and, you know, present very real social justice concerns around these new technologies maybe being available for a small portion of the culture and those who can afford them. And I mean, really the core of the film is looking at, before we get carried away with enhancement and enhancement technologies, let's look at this idea of ableism and sort of how we viewed people with disabilities today. And is there a relationship? Is there some fear? And sort of it's really trying to present different ways of understanding disability. And so you have like Gregor Wahlbring and Patty Byrne who are articulating like, hey, listen, I don't need fancy legs. I need basic health care. I need access to a decent wheelchair that's waterproof. And they're really trying to voice like, we need to be really careful about how we are allocating research funds and who's at the table. And, you know, Marcy Darnovsky from the Center for Genetics and Society, you know, talking about the risks that we may face or that we are facing as, you know, we can select out for different conditions such as Down syndrome, that you'll see, you know, those populations shrinking in the society is, and that there's a real concern about that. That's actually giving a message that people with these different bodies or minds are less valued or less important, and that it's important for us to screen them out if we have that ability.
And Marcy Darnovsky suggests that that message has already been heard loud and clear in populations around the world.
In cultures where sun preference is strong, we say that selecting against girl babies stigmatizes women, tells women, existing women, that their value is lesser than the value of men. And the same could be said of disability deselection. If we routinely select against having a baby with Down syndrome or spina bifida, we're telling existing people with Down syndrome and spina bifida that they oughtn't be here, that their value is less.
Do you think this debate is going to get more heated over the next few years, or that in 20 years it'll be a fundamentally different kind of debate?
I think if there isn't a big shift in our core values around how we're viewing and understanding disability, that the trend is already there. It's already happening that it's quote-unquote common sense that if you have these technologies to screen out, that you will, and that there's going to be more and more social pressure, whether it's regulated or, you know, that it's going to be there. It already is there. And I think that that's only going to get stronger unless we have more space and show a little bit of the different sides of these arguments.
Regan Brashear, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Regan Brashear is the producer and director of the documentary Fixed, the Science/Fiction of Human Enhancement. Still to come, beyond normal, beyond what is considered possible, reaching the peak of human performance involves getting oneself into a nearly out-of-body state, the mental state called flow or the zone. Coming up, the science of flow. But how do you slow it all down, get into your tunnel vision and enter the zone? Tell us by calling 877-8-MY-TAKE. Pushing the edge of human capability regardless of any rules is certainly the mission of people who compete in the X Games.
Here comes T.J. Stiller. Temporary tornado. Stop it, buddy.
Oh, my God.
What in the wide world of sports was that?
16-20, ladies and gentlemen.
The history has just been set at X Games here. There's never been a 16-20 executed in any competition.
That's Canadian freestyle skier T.J. Stiller making history with a double cork 16-20 during the 2011 Winter X Games. And when American skateboarder Danny Wei encounters a wall, he just goes over it.
On that ramp in particular in China, we're very substantial to the point where I almost could barely handle the quarter pipe. The first time I made the jump over the wall, like in the air, I knew I was going to make it, but it was kind of surreal to end up in China. It just seemed too good to be true.
The wall there, it was simply the Great Wall of China. And for Mandy Ray Cruikshank, needing to breathe 289 feet underwater is merely a detail.
When I first started freediving, for me it was just being able to see if I could do that extra few seconds of breath hold or extra few feet of depth. I didn't really have goals of being a world record holder or doing any of the things I had done.
Cruikshank holds the depth record for freediving on a single breath. The door you step through to get beyond traditional biological limits is known by all of these athletes. It's called flow. The mental state of being totally immersed in an activity or a mission. Can humans control and direct their own states of flow? Stephen Kotler is the author of The Rise of Superman, Decoding the Science of Ultimate Human Performance. He says being able to switch the state of flow on and off to maximize performance and creativity is what this new science is all about.
I think we're pushing the limits of what's possible. Back in the early 90s when this kind of acceleration started, there was always this feeling, the journalists who were covering this was, oh, it's got to end. There's no way this can keep going. This has got to be the apex. And year after year after year after year, in pretty much all of the action and adventure sports that you can think of, surfing, mountain biking, skiing, snowboarding, went on and on and on, even the new sports, parkour, things like that, the level of performance has just gone up and up and up and up. And most people, because they don't really pay attention to action and adventure sports, haven't really noticed.
How does this idea of flow throw out the rule book of what we would think biomechanically human beings and human bodies are capable of?
Well, at the elite level of performance, and we've known this for a long time, performance is obviously much more mental, right? So flow is this state of optimal performance where we feel our best and perform our best, and it's a huge mental shift. So at the elite levels, fitness is pretty much on par. Everybody's kind of – they're all in great shape. The difference is the mental edge, and flow is the ultimate mental edge. We're talking about kind of extreme attention, right? This is the end state. But flow is, you know, now demarcated by a number of different fundamental brain states, things going on in the brain.
Time stops.
Time slows down. Your sense of self disappears.
You're at one with whatever it is you're doing.
And we now know the neurobiology of that. So it used to sound really silly, right? Why does time slow down, or why does self disappear, or how do people talk about becoming one with everything, or surfers are like, dude, I was one with the wave.
It's a complete hipster term, but there is neurobiological evidence that flow is a meaningful state in the human mind.
If we want to talk about meaning, that evidence goes back 150 years. We knew in the late 1870s through the turn of the century, William James worked on flow states back then. He didn't quite know what he was looking at.
He took a lot of drugs.
He did take a lot of drugs. But he also worked on flow states. And, you know, one of the things he figured out very early on is it doesn't matter how fantastical these experiences sound, they are significantly psychologically real. Psychologists say people are more complex on the other side of a flow state, which is basically a way of saying it fundamentally alters you, these experiences.
So in this book, who did you meet that kind of blew you away?
All the athletes in the book blew me away. There's no way around it. I was particularly impressed by Dean Potter. He's a great example. He's a rock climber. And one of the things that sets these athletes apart, most people when they have a flow experience, it's a walk on the moon. It's, oh my God, what is going on? This is a profoundly altered state. But these athletes are getting into the state so reliably that they're figuring out how to stretch it, how to use it, how to expand it.
Toggle it on and off.
And Dean, you know, at a time when most of rock climbing, the upper edge, they were doing some free soloing, which is climbing without ropes, and they would do 100-foot pitches, 200-foot pitches, 300-foot pitches. Dean went down to Patagonia alone and started free soloing huge mountains, 2,000, 4,000-foot walls. And he would do one climb, and then he would literally, like, hike across a glacier, not sleep, and do another climb. So, like –
In a sense, you can understand that. I mean, above, whatever, 80 feet, it's closed casket anyway. So anyways, 2,000 feet.
Doesn't really matter, right?
Yeah.
But what he was able to do, and a lot of these athletes can do, is flow states for most people, 20 minutes, an hour. You know, he was able to hold on to these things and stay in the zone for 2, 3, 4 days at a time.
Wow.
And perform at an elite level the entire time. That's incredible. And that's, you know, that's A, what's possible for all of us with flow, right? But that's why these guys are such great case studies, because you're like, okay, here's a guy who has figured out how to stay in this state of optimal performance for days and days at a time. Let's study him and figure out what he's doing, which was kind of the project that led to Rise of Superman.
One of the issues of flow is that it kind of erases the dualities of mind-body, of body-machine, of object-subject, and that in many ways one of the most interesting conversations you had was with Hugh Herr at the Media Lab up at MIT, who's into this biomechatronics, trying to merge humans and machines together to produce a sort of enhancement. How does flow figure into these prosthetic enhancements for people whose bodies are presumably less capable than those of able-bodied folks?
What it does is this is for everybody, and Hugh's work is so exciting for this reason. Most athletes, for example, let's just start with athletes, they don't usually come to flow and kind of the psychological and mental game till late in their careers. Usually they're driven there by injury or something else, they start getting into the mental game, or once they have to start competing with people who are 18 years old and they're 30, they get more into the mental game. But what happens is your body starts to break down. So just as you're starting to master the mental game and really use these states to extend performance, your body's falling apart. What Yu's done by taking kind of bionics that was developed for soldiers and turning it into kind of strap-on exoprosthetics that anybody can use as we get older and that sort of thing is he's allowing us to become flow hackers way into our 60s, into our 70s, into our 80s.
It's flow hackers.
That's the term we've been using for it.
Have you flow hacked into yourself?
I have gotten – well, you know, I make my living as a writer and creativity is – you know, truly great creativity I think is impossible without deep flow. So some of this for me was also necessity. I wanted to understand these states because we know from kind of preliminary research that my organization, the Flow Genome Project, has done – there's all kinds of creativity research that's out there, but we just took a look at like how jacked up is creativity and flow. And it's just a broad general survey, and I'm not hard numbers yet, but the average we're hearing is 7 times, so 700% more creative in flow than out of flow. And this sort of jives with what other researchers have done. So to me, you know, getting up every day, having to face a blank page, knowing how to get into flow quickly is survival as a writer.
Around the house, does that create some tension when your wife tries to say, take out the garbage and you go ham and flow, don't bother me?
No, I take out the garbage. I can take out the garbage in flow.
In flow?
Yeah, I'm that good.
That very good. Stephen Kotler, author of The Rise of Superman, Decoding the Science of Ultimate Human Performance. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
They've got 60-degree weather in Sochi. The Winter Paralympics are a sign of spring this week. Not so much here in the Northeast and even parts of the South. What are you seeing? A bud popping, a robin, something sprouting somewhere? For me, my favorite sign of spring has to be that smell of the newly thawed earth that releases that earthy smell into the air. It tells you that the farmers will soon be planting. Slightly different smell, maybe a little less pleasant in the city when the thaw happens. What gets you in the spring state of mind? Tell us your favorite sign of spring on our Facebook page at facebook.com/thetakeaway. Tweet us at The Takeaway. Use the hashtag MySpringSign. Got it? Hashtag MySpringSign, all one word. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.